Hello, everybody. This is the Neuroqueering Podcast. I'm your host, Pasha Marlowe, back after a small hiatus, and I'm really excited to come back to our first guest of this new season, Whitney Miller, who I've been admiring and following and inspired by for many, many months now on social media. Whitney is a sex educator, pleasure coach, and the CEO of BDE Moves, and a yoga professional, and I'm sure a million other fascinating, nuanced things that we're going to get into. But I love Whitney's energy. And I think, Whitney, you're brilliant and entertaining and down to earth and approachable and all the things that I really just appreciate about a podcast guest. So thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was telling Whitney that my previous podcast was Let Pleasure Be the Measure. So I don't know if I said I was a pleasure expert, but I really value pleasure. And like so many people, I have a hard time accessing pleasure. And I also am coming through the lens of coming out queer to myself and the world about 4 years ago. And then like so many, that started the unraveling of, oh my gosh, what else don't I know about myself? And what what other norms have I been following? So I realized I was neurodivergent and ADHD, autism, and I actually include trauma in neurodivergence. And so that's like all the owners, right? Like, and yeah, and beyond.
Yeah, with the social constructs the way they are, there's a bit of trauma.
For sure. So yeah, I thought it'd be really fascinating to have a conversation. I usually look at things through, you know, neuronormativity and heteronormativity, which I'm sure we'll bring into the conversation, but also talking about sex and intimacy through the lens of patriarchy and heteronormativity, which is your jam. So yay.
Yeah, we're going to put our jams, we're going to jam them together.
It's
going to be awesome.
Awesome. So like this is like a strange question to start with, but it's the first thing that comes to my mind. Like, what makes you angry lately? Like, what gets you just like furious and like fired up to dig into?
Fired up. Just like what's fresh is like somebody the other day in one of my comment sections, it was a cis man. And not all cis men are like this on my platform. Usually I have a great experience with them. They're usually kind. They show up and they want to learn. But this guy shows up in my comment section and says, and I'll give you a little background. The video was about conflict being healthy in relationships, you know, conflict that doesn't escalate to violence, but just conflict resolution and how that creates intimacy. Mm-hmm. And he was like, you don't know what you're talking about. You just need to make love, and that's more than sex. And I was like, whoa, just this idea that you could just sex the conflict away.
Sex the conflict. You could do that. Just have more sex.
Just have more sex, you know. And he's telling me I didn't know what I was talking about. And I said, you know, unresolved conflict will never turn into making love. There's no vulnerability. There's no connection. It's just rubbing skin together.
Yeah. So
basically somebody's masturbating with somebody's body because they lack the emotional maturity to resolve conflict. So that's a big amount of distance. And then he went on to tell me that he was God. So I realized I was dealing with someone that I didn't need to talk to at all. And I just laughed and said, got it. Cause I don't play chess with pigeons. They just sit on the board and say they won. So goodbye.
Oh my goodness. Sometimes I just don't read the comment sections.
I get in there a little bit just so people can see how I deal with it, because usually like one troll will create more. So with like, here's my response. And if you continue to unravel, you're on your own. I'll just leave you there.
Yeah.
I don't have energy for that.
And isn't it fantastic when people who have been following our work for a long time, who probably know that we're not reading every single comment, just start advocating for us and you know, holding space.
Oh, I have amazing followers.
Good.
Amazing. They're kind. They're wonderful. They are educated. They are great at debating. A lot of times I don't even need to come in the comment section.
Right.
And then like somebody will tag me and be like, why aren't you down here talking to us? And I'm like, because this person just schooled the shit out of you and you're good. You're done.
You're done. You don't need anymore. Yeah.
Yeah. I approve this message.
Exactly. Ditto.
Me too, friend.
I love it. That's the best. Oh my goodness. So, heteronormativity, let's just, how would you define it to those listening?
Gosh. Yeah. So heteronormativity is the social construct because it's a default system, basically. Like if you don't take the time to look yourself in the mirror and go, what feels good to me? Mm. You just kind of look around at what everybody else is doing and mimic that and wait for it to feel good because it's feeling good for everybody else. Mm-hmm. So it's supposed to feel good to me. So then you do it, but the feel good doesn't come. So then you're like, oh, I must be broken then. Yeah. There's just something wrong with me. We just internalize it as we're broken because we're not a part of the cog in the machine. You know, yeah. we feel queer. We feel right. Weird.
Right. Yeah. I didn't know I was queer, but I knew that I wasn't experiencing pleasure in my hetero-facing relationships. I knew mm-hmm. I wasn't experiencing pleasure physically, but also emotionally, mm-hmm. romantically, yeah. and all the things.
I did those things.
Yeah.
I married the man. I had the baby. Mm-hmm. I waited for the happy to come.
Right.
Where is it?
Right.
Where is it? Everybody said, this is what I'm supposed to do. And yeah. I went about it all backwards. I came out as gay when I was 15. Mm. I was very just like, I'm gay. And my older brother had already come out. So my family was like, yeah, another one. Cool. Awesome. Do you, boo. And, you know, but I grew up in East Tennessee. So at school, it was not that socially right. acceptable. And I kind of started the fire at my school. I grew up in a very rural area. It's like Dandridge, Tennessee. It's just like the second oldest town in Tennessee. Okay. I think there were 800 people in my graduating class with like 16 of us being not white.
Okay.
So okay. like, I came out and then my visibility, other people started coming out and the principals like called me down to his office about this. Like I was just going to get control of all these gays coming out and being like, hey,
could you handle that?
just get back in there. You know, we're not welcome here or something. And that was his conversation with me. He was like, you started this, all this shit here, you know? And I'm looking at him, I'm 15. I'm like, what? I'm supposed to do. So there was a lot of that. And then there was like physical violence threats. And I'd been kicked off a lot of property. And with the physical violent threats, I got scared. And I was like, maybe I could be bi. Maybe I could do that. So I tried and it was miserable. Mm-hmm. I was so fucking depressed. And I just kept waiting for it to get better. I was like, well, this is what they say happy is this nuclear family. And it ended up in me for like deep debilitating depression until yeah. I looked at my son's father and was like, I'm gay and I can't do this with you anymore. And you know this because we keep having this conversation for right. years now. Right. I can't do this. I can't manage your emotions for you about me leaving. It's not yeah. mine here. Process yeah. it.
Yeah. And so you ultimately divorced and co-parented?
Yeah. We were never married. We were together for 10 years. Okay. So in Tennessee, okay. that is common law, but like we split. This was, this was almost 5 years ago. And we do co-parent. We co-parent very well. Nice. He has finally come through it. It took him like 3 years to like process his emotions and things. And I think that that's a lot of patriarchy there is like, men aren't sure what to do with emotions that don't fit in the anger box.
Mm.
You know, it's like anger is okay. That's socially acceptable. Because
mm-hmm.
patriarchy is shitty for everybody. It's shitty for men too.
For sure.
And that like being anti-patriarchy is not anti-men. I'm pro-men. I want them healthy.
Absolutely. Know? Better for all people.
Like, mm-hmm. like have your full range of emotions. If you have a central nervous system, you have emotions. It's not a gender thing.
Right. Right. Yes, let them be healthy and then let their brains work better and let them make better laws.
Yes, yes. Let's just act accordingly and be accountable for your emotions. Yeah. Like yeah. my ex wanted to put a lot on me, like you're doing this to me. And I'm like, no, this is happening to me and I'm processing it and you need to process how it affects you. But mm-hmm. I'm not going to not be my authentic self so that you can continue on with this playing house.
Yes.
What we were doing. You know, we're just doing life next to each other. We weren't connecting. It wasn't getting deep or anything because I'm depressed. Like, if you want me to stay here and I'm depressed, you don't really love me.
Right.
You just love the situation and like keeping everything like it is.
Yeah. And in all transparency, because I'm sure this a lot of people listening can relate, I'm separated from my soon-to-be ex. I don't know what to call him. But we're living together. The economy, housing market, and a chronically ill child have just left us with dynamics where we're living together in a very hetero-facing life, you know, where not many people even know that I'm queer. But inside our home, it's this really interesting dynamic of, you know, co-parenting platonically and living in the same house platonically. And I know so many people are dealing with that, but it's so interesting how, even though I am 100% certain I'm queer, and even though I'm 100% certain I want to be able to leave, individuate, get my own place, my God, sometime start to date, find love for myself, fulfilling love that's actually pleasurable. And yet sometimes in fear or wanting safety or wanting security or not wanting to, you know, make things too complicated for my son, like all the things that come up. Then I get pissed at myself, like really pissed that I'm kind of scared or falling back into old patterns. And sometimes I think, well, it's because I can't, but sometimes I think it's this fear of not feeling like I could do it on my own, even though intellectually and cognitively, I know I can. I'm just thinking back to our original conversation about like imposter syndrome. And I'm just being honest about the fact that it comes up so much when, in this situation where I'm trying to move apart.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, you think about all the social constructs that are set up to make a woman second guess herself about whether she can take care of herself or whether she knows how she feels or what she thinks is valid.
Yeah.
And even that, when you look at the way that the culture treats like two women in a relationship together, they treat it like foreplay for a man. I mean, it's disgusting. Like, the word lesbian has been sexualized to the point that these relationships are not seen as legitimate. So we have to like meet with all of that and deconstruct it within ourselves and realize that like our 2 feet on the ground is enough. Like, that's enough. You can root and ground in yourself. You don't need somebody on the outside to validate and be like, yeah, bitch, that's right. Like, no, it's like, if it feels right in my heart, that's it. Mm-hmm. I don't need anything else. Mm-hmm. And when we're young, nobody tells us that. So as adults, we have to go out and like pay for therapy. Or for me, it was like immersion programs where they were like telling you, you are enough by yourself, looking in the mirror saying, I'm a bad bitch. And like, that's it. Like, you don't need anybody else to tell you that. Mm-hmm. So it's hard. And it's like, I was telling my fiance yesterday, I was feeling this like in my heart, like a little bit of anxiety. Like, we moved in with each other this week and we're like merging our lives together. And it's just, this is the first relationship I've had where it's a true partnership, where it's not like I'm carrying around my partner's debit card and I'm in the home, like domesticated. Like, we both work and we both have these independent lives that we've brought together. And I realized, I was like, man, this is my first time like feeling like a full ass adult. Like, I'm doing exactly what I want to do.
Yeah.
And it's on the grounds of nothing else. Cause for so long it was like, is this making my parents happy? Is this making, you know, this partner happy? And I don't give a shit about any of that anymore. I'm like, I'm happy.
Yeah.
And that kind of gave me a little anxiety, like, but am I, you know, am I really? Yeah, I am. I am. I'm like very happy. This is exactly what I want to do. And it's like, nobody prepares you for that, that when you get exactly what you want, that it will shake you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Especially if you have a trauma history, you'll kind of wonder, like, what am I missing? When's the other shoe going to fall? You know, what else? If I didn't completely know what was going on, then what don't I know now? It can be really scary. It can be really scary. We get used to the feeling of trauma or chaos or conflict sometimes.
Like, disappointment is common and it's familiar. So I tell my clients all the time, I'm like, you know, comfort zones are not comfortable. They're just familiar. We should call them familiar zones.
Yeah.
That's all they are.
I hear you. And so, gosh, this is so cool. So you've just moved in with a woman.
Yeah.
I was just making an assumption.
Yeah, my fiance. She's a woman.
And you're,
she's a woman. Yeah.
And you're getting married. And this is, and so it's like you're living these original thoughts as a.
This 15 year old me is looking at me and being like, see, this is what I said.
Right. All that time ago, I knew. That's so cool. I'm so happy for you.
Thank you. It's hilarious because my mom, she's my stepmom, but she's mom. Yeah. She adopted me when I was 15. When I was like getting arrested and doing all the bad things, she was like, yeah, I'll sign papers and be your guardian. So at my worst time in my life, she took me in and loved me. So she's mom.
Nice.
She said when I left my son's father, she looked right at me and was like, well, we just figured me and your father thought that you were going to have a baby and that you would leave and that you would be with a woman. Like, we thought that that's just what you want to do. I was like, you thought I was out here just trying to like steal somebody's sperm and then go, like, that's what you and dad talk about. Like, you just had a chat. Like, you know, Whitney, she's probably just going to have a baby and then move on to women.
So they were not surprised.
No, they were just like, yeah, this is what we thought you would do. Like, I was like, thanks for telling me. Yes.
It's funny when it's anticlimactic when we come out. When I came out in 2019, I was so nervous to come out. I wrote a book about it first. It's kind of a strange way to do it. But I wrote a book called My Next Husband Will Be a Lesbian.
Yeah.
And my coming out was like showing my family my book. Here, great, I wrote a book. You're in it. Here, just go read it. And nobody was surprised. They're all just like, my older son, who's autistic, he says, how many pages is it? I was like, that's your only question about me coming out. He's like, how many pages is in your damn book? Yeah, that's it. That was the only question he ever had. It was like the non-issue. Nobody was surprised. Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
When I came out at 15, I didn't even get to come out. My mom opened the closet door and is like, what are you doing in here? And I bought a book of like memoirs, like lesbian memoirs. Like, I'm 37 now, this is 22 years ago. And I was at Barnes and Noble's and trying to find something to help me because I'm like, I'm not into boys like my friends are and think something's going on with me. And this girl hit on me the other day and boy, that made my skin feel really warm and nice. And I want to know what's going on. And she saw me like sneaking to buy this book. And she calls me down to her room and I come down. I'm like, hey. And she was like, honey, you know, you want to sit down? Do you think you're gay? And I start crying like it's some Christian conservative family I'm coming out to. Like my brother isn't 17, out and open and accepted. I don't know what was wrong with me, but she's just like, it's okay, baby. Like, it's fine. Like, Jason's gay. Like, if you be gay. My dad's a redneck. So he was like, well, at least you won't get pregnant, you know? But yeah, it wasn't long after that they realized they had to stop letting me have sleepovers. They were like,
all these girls
can't have overnights anymore. My mom came to my room and my girlfriend had like pulled her shirt on inside out and backwards. So the tag's like right here. The room smells like guilt. It's just
that's awesome. Yeah, we can get away with sleepovers with our girlfriends for a long time.
I got away with it for a good bit. I had some fun and cut that the fuck off. They were like, we cannot do that. Those are minors and we could get in so much trouble.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. That's amazing. That's amazing. I love it. And when you were talking about, go back to the warm and fuzzy feeling part, which reminded me of attraction and how we feel. But you mentioned things beyond just sexual attraction and the physical sensations. Like what do you want to tell me about attraction?
Oh my gosh. So attraction is so complex and it's so layered. Like there's platonic attraction, like when you're attracted to someone because you want to be friends with them. Mm-hmm. And then there's aesthetic attraction. And I get this a lot for like feminine presenting men. I just think they're beautiful. Mm-hmm. I don't want to wrap my legs around them, but I can't stop staring because they're just gorgeous. Mm-hmm. But there's not like that sexual magnetism, like, oh, I want to take your clothes off. It's just like those clothes are laying on you so good. And I cannot stop looking away. And I'm going to give you a compliment if I get close enough. And there's skill set attraction. Like when you see someone doing something that they're passionate about, like singing or playing the guitar, and you get this feeling almost like just like a, you can feel the dopamine in you because that person is doing something that they're just like, they're made for that.
Yeah.
And that could trigger sexual attraction, but sometimes it's just, you just are a magnetism. Attraction is like magnetism, and there's different types of magnetism we feel for people.
Yeah.
Because there's asexual people who are interested in romantic attraction and they don't feel that sexual magnetism. And then I could go all down a deep hole with that, because there's asexual people who are sex seeking because they like the physical sensation of sex, but they don't feel the sexual attraction.
Right. Right. So, yeah.
Because ace is an umbrella in itself. Mm-hmm. Ace doesn't equal celibacy.
Thank you. Yes.
Yeah. It's so big and vast and very complex. And there's so much nuance to it. But I feel like society loves these boxes. They're addicted to them. They love it. They're like, okay, you're a lesbian, so that means you're only attracted to women. Well, then we have to talk about what makes someone a woman. Right. And everybody wants to point to what's between their legs, but that's not what makes someone a woman. No. Having a vulva doesn't mean you're a woman. A lot of beautiful trans men and trans mass people with vulvas, they're not women. They're non-binary people with vulvas. They're not women, you know? And what I think what's behind all this is that people are afraid to say who they're attracted to, and they're afraid what society will think about them because they're attracted to that person. And that's why they like the boxes, is because that keeps everybody in their zone. And I'm like, yeah, but does that not make you turn your back on yourself at some point?
Yeah. Like, and you change and evolve, and your experiences change and evolve, and you become more nuanced, and then you might change your mind.
You stop caring about what other people think, you know, especially when you get like 35 plus, that shit doesn't fucking matter anymore. And that's why you see these droves of people coming out of the closet, like around that age point, because it's like from before there, like in your 20s, everything is for everybody else. Everything you do is for everybody else. The way you dress, put your clothes on, it's the way that people are receiving you, and you forget to think about how you're receiving yourself or if you're being authentic to yourself.
Yeah.
And then, like, and that's why I just call myself queer. I can't predict the future for you, you know? And it's like with my partner, we're engaged in everything, but we do intentional monogamy where we're constantly checking in with each other. Like, hey, you still choosing me today? I'm still choosing you today. Awesome. I love that for us. You let me know if there's somebody else you want to explore energy with, and we can expand what our relationship looks like, because I don't want to own you. I want to pursue happiness beside of you.
So beautiful. It's just
keeping it real.
I've not heard that term before, intentional monogamy.
Yeah. It's the ethical non-monogamy community has beautiful words to like expand how we look at relationships. And my partner introduced that to me, because we were both poly when we met each other, and we had like other people who kind of like, you know, compulsory monogamy people look at just dating. I guess that's kind of what we were doing at the beginning. And then we had like intended to just keep that going, like, oh, we'll just continue practicing polyamory because we were just looking for fun. But we found that the more time we spent with each other, the less emotional space and energy and time we had for other partners. And she was like, I feel polysaturated with just you. And that's another term from the ethical non-monogamy community to explain that you don't have the capacity for other partners. Like,
yeah. Well, what do you mean? So polysaturated, you don't have the capacity, but is it also that your relationship is fulfilling on many levels? Is that the saturation? Yes. Okay.
Yeah. It's fulfilling it. And like, she fulfills all my romantic and sexual needs. And then anything else I need, I get through my platonic relationships with my friends, because there's not hierarchy of relationships. Your romantic relationships are important, yes, but my friendships are very important. And like interactions like what you and I are having right now, this is fulfilling as well, like intellectual stimulation.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that term, polysaturated. Very cool. And you're speaking to me on so many different levels in the, on the attraction side of things. And one of the reasons why perhaps I regret the title of my book. I mean, I did what I did at the time. It seemed like the best idea, but I was with the understanding that if I didn't want to be with men, I wanted to be with women. If I was wanted to be with women, that meant I was lesbian, or that I would hopefully someday identify, as a lesbian. I was still very much in the messy middle questioning. Nonetheless, that is not how it's played out. I've not partnered with anyone, and it's now 5 years anyhow. And it's, for me, I'm literally waiting for a human to light me up.
Yes.
I have no words for this other than, like, I know I'm not straight. I know I'm queer, but I have no, like, identity, but I have a very hard time becoming attracted to people sexually. But I do often have what you're talking about on these different levels of attraction. So I really love it. Like, I have platonic attractions. I have attractions from skill set. I have attractions intellectually and creatively. And when I'm in conversation with somebody and I'm thinking and I'm laughing and my thoughts are expanding and I'm feeling curious and alive for the first time, seemingly all day or all week or all month, then I start to feel like, could this also turn into sexual attraction? Like, so I'm in that place where I'm not quite sure, because I value more the emotional connections and the feeling alive and the feeling lit up. And then I think, well, maybe I could become sexual with this person who's lighting me up. And yet you don't know, maybe until you know, until you're there. So anyhow, I'm not really making sense in that.
No, you're making perfect sense, because the first thing that comes to my mind is when I'm looking at someone or like this conversation itself is, how do you create safety? And that's not a general term. Like, safety for one person could seem like chaos to the next person. You know, I've got clients who love to be tied up. I've got other clients who are like, if you bring that rope toward me, I'm going to have a trauma response.
Yes.
You know? Yes. So for people who are, say, like on the avoidant attachment spectrum, I use attachment as a spectrum because it's such a blend. Again, it's not these easy boxes, but like people who lean more avoidant, they love casual encounters. They love a one night stand because that feels emotionally safe to them, because the closer you get to them, they start to feel overstimulated and want to pull away. It doesn't feel safe anymore. To the opposite end, like someone who's more anxious, they want that emotional depth.
Yeah.
So they would need like more to get into a sexual attraction feeling with someone. That emotional connection and depth gives them safety, where that emotional depth makes the avoidant person feel scared and it doesn't feel safe anymore.
Yes. Yes. I'm definitely on the anxious side. You're like, no kidding.
Yeah. No, I need reassurance. I am such an anxious person. I said to my partner, we were talking about something and I was needing reassurance, and she thought that like she was supposed to do an action. And I realized when I was looking at her that I needed to explain the feeling behind what I was saying more than say what was happening. I was like, I can see your face right now that you think that you need to jump into action for something. And all I need you to do is tell me that I'm spinning out and that I need to settle down.
Nice.
just say that to me and I'll start processing and settling down.
And how wonderful that you have a partner that you can communicate with in such a way that your partner knows what that means, like that you're spinning out. That's great. Yeah. I definitely need a trauma-informed partner. And when I talked to my sex therapist, who ironically is a man, and he's doing such a phenomenal job helping me reframe a lot. But now I'm going to talk a little bit about neurodivergence from a neurodivergence lens, especially I would say in this case, maybe my autism and trauma really showing, like, if there is not safety, there will be no kind of sex. There will be no emotional connection. Yeah. I was watching that Netflix movie, How to Build a Sex Room. And I was like, all of it was just, it felt like too much.
Yes.
First of all, contrived, but also too much. And I'm like, where is the fire extinguisher in case that candle catches fire? Where? I was like, seriously going through like a safety checklist in my head.
The way that she pulled handcuffs out all the time, I was like, that is the worst bondage choice ever, 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 ever.
The trauma-informed part of me was like, no.
Terrible. Are you not going to talk about safety shears? Are you, I do so much kink and I'm like, there has to be like all of these measures in place. And she was just taking these little vanilla people and just slinging the whole dungeon at them with no preface.
Yes. And I myself have never experienced or explored kink, but I'm open to it because my sex therapist has really been great about saying, you know, what's interesting is how much safety and consent and communication is built into that community. It's like, it's actually really well aligned. And, but it doesn't, I didn't know that. I didn't know that. To me, it just felt scarier.
Yes. And like movies like 50 Shades of Grey and The Secretary, they don't help. But if you actually go to a real established dungeon, it is full of neurodivergent and people on the autism spectrum.
Interesting.
Because there's so much clear communication. There's so much follow-up. There's so much redundancy. Like, hey, I'm about to put this cuff on your wrist. Is that okay? And here's a safe word if you don't like this, and you can get out anytime you want to. Like, it's just like almost like astronauts going to space with the redundancy. Like, your first aid kit, you have alcohol wipes, here's the safety shears. Like, that's real kink. It's so risk aware and safe.
That's really cool. That's reminding me of when I say structure equals freedom. It's like structure doesn't have to be rigid and boring. It's like the structure allows us to play. And be free.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's the language that's provided. I do a lot of things where a lot of content that's like BDSM things for vanilla folks. Like, I'm trying to bring that together because so many people look at people who practice kink as like, is that some trauma shit you're working out? And I'm like, sometimes it is. But the point is that the person who is working it out is given this like nest to sit in with it. And they're in the driver's seat, which is the spin on someone who's like working through trauma, is that trauma is when power was taken from you. And kink is a place where we give your power back in tenfold. And, you know, in ethical non-monogamy communities, they do the same thing. They create a ton of language and redundancy and transparency where people experience trauma, like relationship trauma. Like, lots of us have that.
Yeah.
So even if you're going to be in monogamy, so intentional monogamy is like polyamory language and transparency, but done in a monogamous relationship. So this is also good for people neurodivergent on the autism spectrum because of all that, you know, we're already overthinking, you know how we do. We've already got a narrative up here. We're making a lot of assumptions. And anytime you assume, you're missing an opportunity to connect.
Yeah.
And we have to connect through language. So having all of this language in the BDSM community and the ethical non-monogamy community helps us bridge over to one another so that we can have real intimacy, which is I'm sharing my mind with you.
Yeah, exactly. That feels so good. It feels aligned and integrated with who I am and will resonate so much with people out there listening. And do you, I know a lot of my clients are neurodivergent and queer. Do you find that overlap? I know it's there, but do you find that in all of your clients or is it just some?
Most of my clients hit somewhere on the spectrum. I haven't figured out where the Venn diagram is for all that, but it's like, I noticed it very blaring when I started going to BDSM dungeons, that there were a lot of people on the spectrum there. And it made so much sense. It just hit me over the head. I was like, well, of course, because we're all being so clear and, you know, just like straightforward and there's no assumptions whatsoever. And it's like the aftercare follow-ups, like that was a huge empowering experience for me. Cause when I was single was when I started going to the dungeon. And at that point in time, I wasn't mixing kink with sex like I did before when I practiced kink before, it was like in relationships, but my first time going to like a public dungeon, or it's private, it's like invitation only, but I'm in the room with a lot of strangers.
I'm like trying to figure out what you mean by dungeon, but I'm just like,
so
pretending
I'm going to try to like paint you a picture from here. So we're not just over here in the land of assumption. It's a 3,000 square foot concrete room that is cleaner than any hospital I've ever been in. And there are places set up for scenes. So a scene is like carried out between one or more people that have negotiated what will happen. So there are props. Sometimes there's like a St. Andrew's cross, which is like a huge X where somebody can be like hooked to it with restraints, little D-ring carabiners, if they like that thing. Bondage makes me feel free because I have a lot of sexual energy. So I feel like when I'm tied up, I can just let all that out. So usually people who like bondage, they feel like they have a ton of sexual energy and it makes them feel like they can just let it all out because they're tied up. They won't overpower the other person. Wow. Or sometimes they like the feeling of surrendering and being overpowered by someone. It feels good.
Where is this dungeon? Is this like in every city near you?
Oh my gosh, they can be. So you get on FetLife to find the local ones in your area and then you have to vet. So a vetting process would be done at what's called munches. And munches are done in public settings, like a restaurant. And you just meet all these kinky people in a regular public setting, and they decide if you would be safe there. And you decide if you would be safe there by meeting them in a public space first.
What's munch mean?
So munch is when you're meeting the kinky people in a public setting, because you have to vet each other because it's such an intimate thing. Okay. So that's what they call it on FetLife. When you see the word munch, it means public setting that is safe. It's in a general public. So again, like that, lots of redundancy, communication, transparency, and like vetting process.
Okay.
Making everything safe. So you don't just like show up to the dungeon and walk in, whoever you are. You can't do that. That's not okay. You have to sign a waiver and you have to pay like a door fee and everything. It's wonderful. And then like the place where I was at, there's this 3,000 square foot concrete room and it's super clean. The walls are nice and painted, but everything is like all the surfaces are sanitizable, basically is what's happening.
Yeah.
There's no sex allowed in the dungeon, only kink. So you won't see people like having intercourse or oral sex or anything like that. Okay. You just see people acting out kink. So that could be electric play with like violet wands. And I know some of these things are going to be like, what's that? But like Google that, because we're going to, I could go forever with that. Or you can see somebody getting bondage, and impact play is usually a lot of what goes on in there. But there's even like captivity where there's like these cages that are like human cages, and some people like to be put in there.
I have a question. Like,
yeah, let's go. Okay. Let's go.
So you're saying there's no sex?
No sex.
But you're talking about things that I assume are arousing. And so if somebody's getting this done, somebody's bound to have an orgasm. There's going to be fluids.
Like, I have had an orgasm in the dungeon. Yes.
Yeah. So how is that not considered sex?
I mean, in my definition, that would be sex. But right. To the general public, they usually think of sex as genital action.
Oh, like if it's penetration. So,
there's no genital action happening.
Okay. Sorry. I just had to.
No, great question. Actually, great. Because, there was a nipple play situation and the person topping me like squeezed my nipple in just the right time and just the right way. And I had an orgasm and I didn't know I could do that. So that was one thing. It was like,
good information.
Well, do not know that about myself. Thank you.
And so another question, somebody who ruminates a lot and has an active mind and kind of spinning thoughts, and probably my main barrier for enjoying pleasure during sex would be my mind thinking too much and getting distracted. Kink potentially because of the, I don't know, I'm just making this up, but higher level of stimulation, like, does it sometimes get you out of your head so you're not ruminating so much? I'm just guessing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And that's part of the appeal to it is like impact play is tons of sensation. I have nowhere to go but to be in my body. I'm being flogged. Like, you know, sometimes I'm being asked to count the flogging. So now I'm really here because I'm one. Two.
Oh, very three. Present.
Very, both people. So I started out with bottoming and impact play, but now in my present relationship, my partner asked me, she was like, I want to be your submissive. I want to submit to you. And I was like, oh, I've never been anybody's dominant before, but I know how to do it. And I, you know, let's work it out. So we worked it out. So now I do the flogging and it's heavily just so intense. Like I experienced so much euphoria through her because I know what that flogger feels like when she moans.
I'm literally pretending to know what flogging is right now.
Okay, sure.
Oh yeah, flogging.
I got you. Hang on.
What? Are you going to flog in front of me? Is this? I'm going to witness my first flogging. We are now on Neuroqueering. I'm going to have to give the play by play for those that are just listening. She's got a whole lot of purple and black leather.
So this
it's
is
like a cheerleading. It's like a cheerleading pom pom, but not
it's
longer
long and leather. This is heavy. So when it comes down and it hits, it's like a thudding sensation.
Okay. So I got it.
It goes over a wide surface of area so that it's not a stingy sensation. Now I have other toys for stingy sensations if somebody likes that, but most people like to start out with a thud. So when someone's getting flogged, this is what they're getting hit with. Is this
got it? Okay.
Yeah. So the smell of it too can be triggering, like can trigger a delicious sensation because it's like if you smell the leather, then you remember the last time you smelled the leather and the pleasure that you experienced with it.
Okay, I have another question. So, because you say leather, and I think belt, and I think whipping, and I think spanking, and I get into my trauma space. So, which I'm sure is common to get like triggered by different smells and sensations, but like that feels like too close to me to like being spanked as a child. So, how do you bridge that if I'm like want to be flogged someday, but now that's where my head went, so that would be a barrier.
So this is a part of rewriting those narratives, is that we pick up the story from there and we rewrite it with pleasure. Like, you have a story that's like tied up in like fear and shame and you not being in control. And we pick that story up and we rewrite it with you being in control and you receiving pleasure and you being able to say when it starts, when it stops, what toy you use. Because like when I was bottoming, somebody would just hand me their bag of impact toys and be like, hey, go through that and tell me which ones that you don't want me to use, which ones you do want me to use, you know, and they would just act accordingly with that. So there's a negotiation that happens before. That's the huge part. So everybody is acting within the boundaries and limitations, and there's where we get the trust. So it's an active trust exercise. It's like, I'm not going to hit you harder than you want me to. I'm going to stop when you want me to. I'm not going to use anything on you you don't want me to. And then you start to rewrite these narratives. Now you have a new memory. So now leather brings up the last interaction that you had instead of the traumatic one.
Yeah. Cool. I have, when I work with couples, not with kink clearly. Good. I'm really glad you're not coaching because vanilla. Anyhow, but we do talk about code words and during sex and intimacy, or even just a social situation that we want to get out of, we talk about code words. So I'm just curious if you have a certain practice or preference about choosing the code words or which ones you have found to be common. Cause people are always like, I can't think of one. And then and it always comes back to pineapple or something.
It's always pineapple. I don't know what it is about the pineapple.
Well, I know that pineapple has some like roots in like the swinging world, right?
Yes. You put them on your porch to like let people know that you're a swinger. You wear pineapples to like signal to other people who know what the pineapple means. It's like rainbows for queer people. I'm not sure.
Oh, but it might have been in an SNL skit. Anyhow,
I don't know. In the BDSM community for safe words, we have three because there's a hard and a soft, and I'll explain. And so we use the traffic light system. Green means go. Yellow means I'm close to my maximum edge. Like if I'm hitting, like, for example, if I'm doing impact and somebody's like, that last hit was stronger than I wanted, but I don't want you to stop, they'll say yellow.
Yellow.
Okay. So I know that means to tamp it down, but they also don't want to stop. But if somebody says red, that means everything stops immediately and we start aftercare. So if you want cuddles, water, snacks, Netflix and chill, or to be left alone, we start the aftercare.
I like it. It's easy. It's something universal, you know?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Brilliant. I love all this. This has taken such a different turn than I thought we'd be talking.
It's so complex. I tell you, it's so complex. And I'm pleasure like, spelled different by everybody.
It's so funny because the levels of, when we started talking about heteronormativity, that the levels of moving away from heteronormativity are so vast. And like, and so I'm just recognizing and witnessing in myself like how much further and more expansive I can become.
That's where I'm at. That's where I'm at. That's where I was telling you about attraction in these boxes. I was like, I've studied sex and attraction and arousal and desire for so long now that I'm like, oh my gosh, it's the heteronormativity that is making queers recreate heteronormativity under the rainbow. Yes. They don't understand that like being lesbian, pan, bi, that's just heteronormativity with a rainbow painted on it. Like it's just more complex than that.
That's what it feels like. That's why it hasn't been attractive to me. Interesting. Yeah.
It's not just, it's just rigid once again, you know, and then you get into like gold star lesbians and platinum gays. Yeah. And now we're right back to being obsessed with genitals, which is ridiculous.
Yeah. And hierarchy and all
of yes. that. And that's patriarchy. That's white supremacy patriarchy. When you're talking about judging someone based off of their sexual history, hell, that's purity culture. That's patriarchy 101. Exactly. And then I keep arguing with these Gold Star lesbians, and they think that it's not that because they're women. They're like, well, I can't be patriarchy because I'm a woman. And I'm like, it's the same tool and you're using it in the same way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the opposite of patriarchy is not a matriarch. It's equality.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You gotta get rid of the hierarchy, honey. It's got to go.
Yes. 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 I think I stitched you on TikTok when you said that, because it really impacted me. The opposite of patriarchy is not matriarchy, it's equality.
That's Bell Hooks. You know, Bell Hooks taught me that.
Okay. And actually, it's interesting. I was just thinking about Audre Lorde. You can't dismantle the master's house with the master's tools.
Yes. They might. Yes. Black women are always going to tell you how to heal better than anybody else. They are going to tell you, you cannot get healing from white men. Like, everybody's like, oh, read The Body Keeps the Score. I'm like, that's just some other white dude trying to sell me healing. You're the oppressor. What would you know about healing?
I'm so with you. I don't have that. I don't even have that book anymore. Have you read the Judith Herman one that just came out? It's really nice that it's a woman, Truth and Repair, but it's about how, your trauma turns into activism and justice. Yes. Work. So that's really cool. What's that?
It's like, damn right. Your trauma turns into activism. Fuck yes.
Exactly. Unfortunately, the person who wrote the little stinking, what do you call it, on the top of the book, go figure, you know, was Vanderkolk, but whatever.
I know.
He approves this message. I'm like, dang it. That's why I didn't buy him.
That's the imposter syndrome, is that we feel like some white man needs to tell us that we did a good job. And it's where women can smell their inferiority next to the cis man in a patriarchal society. So instead of fighting that, they compete with other women for this need to like rise up and above. Well, it's like, well, I'm better than that woman. And I was like, we're all the same. That's the point. Nobody's better. We're just different. Shit.
Oh gosh. Yeah. Oh, I can feel my brain going on like so many tangents right now. And right. You and my listeners probably like, oh, this is a whole new podcast episode.
Like, have you read Communion by Bell Hooks?
Communion. No, I don't think I have.
Oh my gosh. It's such an easy read. It's a small book and it's Communion.
Okay.
The Search for Female Love. And she even has a whole chapter for lesbians in there. And that's where it hit me that Gold Star lesbian was just another hierarchy in queer society. And they're not alone in that. Like platinum gay men, these are men that are born in cesarean births. So they've never touched a vagina. Therefore, they are the most gay. And I'm like,
that was their choice in doing. What the heck?
Out of here. And then when I have these conversations with people who identify as Gold Star lesbians, they argue with me that they should be allowed to be proud. And I'm like, proud of what? And they say, well, I was true to myself. And I'm like, well, so were late bloomers. They were acting on the information that they had at that time and acting accordingly with what felt authentic to them with the information that they had at that time. So again, what are you proud of?
Mm-hmm. 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 Yeah. Yeah.
And what are you saying about those women when you say like, oh, I made it and I was true to myself and I didn't do what society told me that I should do?
Yeah. There's a lot of looking down on. I dated one day, 1 hour, a Gold Star lesbian who that's how she identified. And immediately, the narrative was, I'm lesser than, I wasn't as true to myself. I wasn't as brave. I wasn't as intuitive. And then we had an interesting conversation about public displays of affection because, I was saying, you know, I was pretending it was going well, but it wasn't, asking if I could hold her hand. And she said, there you go again, because you didn't have to do all the work to fight for us to feel safe, to hold hands in public. So no, you can't come out as some newbie, lesbian just late on the scene who like thinks it's okay and safe to have public displays. I was like, I'm sorry. What the fuck? It was really
fascinating. This is like silencing women and quieting women. And it's like, there's nothing feminist about any of that. And it's just, oh man, it's so odd to me. And it's like, I do have the experiences of the violence and knowing how it's an act of courage to hold hands in public, but I've also slept with cis men. So I still understand what she was saying. I would never say it that harshly to someone. It's like, my partner grabbed my hand. We were going to a grocery store in the country town that I live in. I think you were there for this conversation where I just kissed her hand and I said, hey, that's not safe for us to do that here. And the only difference was that she grew up in Miami where this was a non-issue and I'm in a country town. So it's not even that, you know,
that's a very compassionate, respectful way of doing it. And had she said, you know, that she doesn't feel safe, even if I thought it felt safe, you know, and this goes back to like from a trauma informed place, you can never say I'm creating safe space. Like we're in a safe space because you don't know if the other person feels safe or not. I felt safe at the moment. She did not. And so had she said that, you know, versus shaming me, it would have gone over a lot better.
Yes. But it's like the whole rhetoric is coming from a place of insecurity where we're like trying to put people through these paces of like, well, how gay are you? And I'm like, oh my God, like now we're back to attraction and how it is more than the flesh on somebody's bones. Okay. Like if you think that attraction is just skin deep, then you're about as deep as a fucking puddle.
Yes.
Just say that you're shallow. Just say that, but don't try to put us all in the fucking box. As if being a lesbian means I'm attracted to all women, but you're not. You're attracted to the women that you're attracted to for reasons more than them just being a woman.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Oh, goodness. All right. This is that moment where I'm like, I could talk to you forever and I wish I could because I'm going to go back to my boring heterophasic life and this sounds so much better and this feels really good. But alas, my listeners will not.
They only have so much time.
They only have so much time. Their car ride or wherever they've been driving, listening to this, they've already arrived. They're now in the parking lot waiting for us to wrap it up.
Maybe a disclaimer before. This one's for the road trip.
There you go. The road trip. I love it. But so much fun and such a pleasure meeting you, Whitney.
This is awesome. I usually don't get to talk like this, so I appreciate it.
Oh, good. I just assume you talk like this all the time.
No, I talk like this to my partner. I'm working up the nerves like, you can't talk like this on TikTok. You only get 200 views.
Or banned or something, right?
You get this.
Yeah. Well, I'm happy to have another conversation anytime.
Yeah. Just hit me up. Make time for it for sure. I love this.
Great. Well, I will be talking to Whitney again soon. And if people want to talk to you, reach out to you, follow you, all the things, how do they do it?
They do it from my website. It's a BDE-moves.com. And you can find everything there. My YouTube, my Instagram, my TikTok, my private Facebook group, my Patreon community. I also have an OnlyFans. If you're into that, come on over. I do everything.
It's like dungeon style OnlyFans.
No, it's just like home videos of me and my fiance, like having morning sex or whatever sex we're having that day. In the future, we thought about putting like impact scenes and stuff on there, but we just was like threw the camera up and was like, hey, you want to see this? Here's the monthly rate for that.
Awesome. I love it. I'm like, and if you want to talk to me, I have no sex scenes to show you. I've got no... Anyhow, you can find me on TikTok and Instagram and Facebook and at PashaMarlo.com. And by the way, if BDE, if you want to know what it stands for, it's Big Dick Energy. So it's BDE in case it was hard to hear what the letters were for those that are just listening. Because I had to ask too. All right. Well, so much fun. Thank you, Whitney.
Yeah.
Awesome. And for those that are listening, if you like this episode, of course, all the things, you know, like it and star it and review it, but also share it because hopefully this conversation will help enlighten or inspire or liberate somebody. And it would be really exciting to hear your thoughts on it. So feel free to reach out. Cool. All right. Thank you, Whitney. Bye. Before you go, I have a favor to ask. Please subscribe to this podcast. That way you won't miss an episode and it'll help me bring it to folks who need it most. Fellow ADHD minds out there, I know you're going to forget. I would too. So let's push that button now and subscribe. Awesome. Thank you so much. Bonus points if you spread the word of the Neuroqueering podcast by sharing it or reviewing it. Thank you. Also, if you want to see more of me, please follow me on TikTok, Instagram, and YouTube at NeuroQueerCoach. Sign up for coaching at PashaMarlow.com, or to guest on my show or leave feedback, email at Pasha at NeuroQueering.com. Thanks all. Happy NeuroQueering. Enjoy your day.